On this episode of Skeptico, Dr. Raymond Moody explains why new science researchers must adhere to reason and remain skeptical.
So much fun to apply the rules of reason. People resort to reason because they are seeking the unique legitimacy that reason provides. Like nobody balances their checkbook by the astrology column, right?
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and we're joined today by someone whose name you will immediately recognize, and he's the best-selling author who's appeared on too many television and radio shows to possibly mention, and is recognized throughout the world as a pioneering scholar and researcher of near-death experience. He's an MD, having received degrees from the Medical College of Georgia. He's also a PhD in philosophy from the University of Virginia. Dr. Raymond Moody, thank you so much for joining us on Skeptico.
Well, thank you, sir. I'm happy to be here.
Terrific. You know where I thought we might start is I think it would be very interesting to me to hear the story of how you first encountered this research, how you first even got the idea. I mean, obviously, you were a scholar, a very serious student, and heading in a direction that I'm sure you couldn't have anticipated, studying survival of consciousness. Well, can you tell us what maybe those first experiences were that led you to think maybe this is something you need to look into a little bit further?
Well, yes, sir. I tell you, when I was 7 years old, I became, which I still am, a devotee of astronomy and built my first telescope when I was seven. And although my parents officially called themselves Presbyterians, in fact, my dad was a surgeon and a military officer. And if you put those two personalities together, the point is that my dad just thought religion was bunk, and so I really was not exposed to that sort of stuff. We went to the Presbyterian Church just for a few months when I was 12 years old. Maybe my dad was going through his midlife crisis about that time or something. But I just grew up assuming that death is like an obliteration, or is like an obliteration of consciousness when somebody is passing away. And so with the intention of becoming an astronomy PhD, but also having had since high school a very intense interest in philosophy, when I got to the University of Virginia in 1962, just within a few days, I decided I was going to be a philosophy major. And what clinched it for me was reading Plato and his writings, and Plato's Republic in particular. And as many know, the last part of the Republic is a story about a man who is believed dead and apparently killed on the battlefield. But just as his companions are getting ready to dispose of his body, he suddenly sat up and he told the story about going into another realm. Well, then about a year later, I was reading Lucian of Samosata, who happens to be one of my very favorite writers of antiquity also, and he told a very similar story about this other person. And so gradually I learned that the ancient Greek philosophers had been interested in this, but it never occurred to me that it might be anything that pertained to more than ancient Greece. So what happened was that in 1965, I was a third-year student of philosophy, and one of my philosophy professors mentioned that right there in Charlottesville at the medical school was Dr. George Ritchie, who had been pronounced dead, and in the interim had this experience. And George was willing and happy, as a matter of fact, to talk with students around the campus with this. So I took the opportunity to listen to one of Dr. Ritchie's lectures sometime in 1965 and realized at that moment that what this that I had thought of as something pertaining to ancient Greece was now something that I heard from a living human being. Dr. Ritchie was the first living person I ever heard this story from. So then, he was very impressive as a person, and then to fast forward 4 years, when I got my PhD in philosophy, one of the very first philosophy courses I taught, a young man came up afterwards and started asking me about the question of life after death and so on. I said, well, why do you want to talk about that? And he said that about a year before, he was in a horrific wreck, and he had the injury, the scars to prove it. And he said that during that time, he had this experience that he said changed his life. And so, of course, I said, well, tell me about your experience. And I was astonished to find it was virtually the same thing I'd heard from George Ritchie about 4 years before. So that then when I went to medical school several years later, I already had a number of cases of this, and then began to talk with lots of patients who were resuscitated and so on. And so that's how it all evolved.
Now, certainly at some point, some of your academic advisors had to kind of try and steer you out of this. I mean, this was...
Well, no. As a matter of fact, to the contrary. That's, I often hear the story, oh, poor Dr. Moody was persecuted and, you know, whatever. So, but really, that didn't happen. The interesting thing that happened was that in 1972, when I went to medical school, I had been the PhD in philosophy route and also had taught philosophy for 3 years. So... obviously, a number of people that I grew up with were ahead of me in medical school. Some of them were then residents there and so on. And so they had spread the word among the faculty before I came that this medical student was coming in September who had been doing this work. And as a matter of fact, within the first few weeks of medical school, a number of professors went out of their way to call me and meet me and tell me either that they had had such experiences themselves and were happy that I was doing this research, or on the other hand, that they had seen the same thing with patients, and so it had intrigued them. And so actually, I mean, it makes a nice story to say I was martyred and persecuted. I do have a little bit of a martyr complex, I guess, but that really didn't happen. And
well, that's great. Maybe it was this philosophy guy. Maybe it's, hey, here's somebody we can kind of open up to and
well,
ask.
Well, you know, I think it was that. To me, that was the really wonderful thing about this experience was that I was doing this at a time where people were grateful for somebody to listen to them because this was something that they had. They weren't aware that it had ever happened to anyone else, and they were feeling that they couldn't talk about it, and for fear of being judged crazy or something. So, all in all, it was a very interesting experience. Of course, you know, to me, this is as I'm sure you realize, when you're known for something in the public eye, that may not be what you are primarily interested in. I said in life after life, my interest was in logic and philosophy of language, and although I didn't mention this because it's a big word, but epistemology was the branch of philosophy I taught. So
could we explore that for a minute? In your book, Life After Life, and in some of the interviews that I've heard you do after that, you have a very, very interesting take. I think that unless it's really carefully thought about, I think it escapes a lot of people.
And it does, because of, you know, we live in an age where people want to hear me say, number one, yes, it's true.
Right.
And number two, that it's scientific. And
right.
I've never been able to figure out what to do about this.
Yes.
Because to me, yes. to imply to people that these kinds of experiences are, quote, scientific evidence of life after death, unquote, is number one, to misinform the public about the scientific method.
Right.
Science is a very important aspect of life, and for people to... And I think, in my judgment of them, the people who say that kind of thing are more naive rather than ill-meaning, but nonetheless, it misinforms the public. And also, another difficulty with that is that by leaping immediately to saying, oh, this has to be scientific for us to take it seriously, that excludes all the other branches of rational knowledge that are not scientific. History, for example, or philosophy, or literary theory, I think, has some interesting things to say about experiences like these. And so you don't have to do a scientific study of this sort of stuff for it to be a serious study.
You know, let me jump in here because I want to kind of refine this point a little bit and give an example. You know, in preparing for this interview, part of the research I did, I stumbled across this very brief clip that you did for a Showtime show featuring Penn and Teller called Bullshit, which I'm sure you're aware of.
Huh.
I
don't remember that particular one. But,
well, it's out there and it's still played, and I thought it just really exemplifies how people can easily misinterpret this point. And you said something like, in these areas like the paranormal research where problems are conceptual and uh-huh. not yet scientific, uh-huh. you make a tremendous mistake when you decide you're going to be either a believer or a non-believer.
Yes, that is exactly right.
This is what you said. Hold on. And then you said, and really, in my opinion, mm-hmm. the believers and the non-believers are the same group. Now, Penn
yes.
Jillette.
The believers and the disbelievers. There's a difference between non-believers
that's right,
and disbelievers.
Right. And I think I took that. I mean, Penn Jillette just jumped all over this, and he got so excited in the, you know, how can he say this? And the believers, you know, and I thought it was such a finely refined point. And what it really said, we had a gentleman on the show not too long ago who made the similar point, and he said it quite slightly differently, but the same thing, that, you know, what it takes for the person who's caught up in scientism and wants to be the disbeliever and
yep.
the fundamentalist religious person, it's a leap of faith to say there can be, and they have to have that leap of faith. They do not want to look at any evidence. They do not want to
That's
explore
right.
anything because
That's
it requires
right.
that leap of faith. So there's
That's
two points.
Right. And also, I mean, people, incredibly to me, I have always enjoyed inquiry because I enjoy the process of discovering
right.
things.
Right.
I have never been able to understand how anybody can get any sort of pleasure out of coming up with some preordained opinion and then contriving the rules of reason to make it come out that way. I mean, that is, number one, so easy to do. And number two, I can't imagine how that could be emotionally satisfying to anyone. I mean, to me, the real pleasure of being a scholar is to actually to follow the rules, number one, to go by the rules of reason, and to apply them as carefully as you can, and then come up with, and then see what you come up with, because that's the fun of inquiry.
Mm-hmm. You know, can you go into a little bit this, the minor point that you, it's not a minor point, let me take that back, but the point that you made, and I want you to expound on it, because I think it's very interesting. And when you say the problems are conceptual
yes.
and not yet scientific, can you explain to us what you meant
yes,
by
indeed.
That?
Yes, indeed. For example, take the question of life after death. The plain fact, and over the years I have been standing in front of people many times when I have said this following thing to them. I say, the sentence, there is life after death is a self-contradiction. And what happens many times to people like that is that they get almost flustered and they sort of get blush for a moment and they sort of stammer something like, why? Yes, it is. because the fact is that death means the state, the irreversible cessation of life. So when you say there is a life after death, that's a self-contradiction. And therefore, as David Hume, the great philosopher who lived from 1711 to 1776, a Scottish philosopher who helped formulate modern notions of causation and inductive logic, said about the afterlife question, he said, by the mere light of reason, it seems difficult to prove the immortality of the soul, which, of course, is a wonderful Humean understatement. And then he went on to say, some new species of logic is required for that purpose, and some new faculties of the mind, that they may enable us to comprehend that logic. Now, Hume was noted for his irony, so he might have been being ironic there and just meaning that since it's self-contradictory to begin with, then by definition, it doesn't fit into our code of logic. But whether he was being ironic or not, the fact is what he said was exactly right. Mm-hmm. That is the real question of life after death, because if we don't really have a coherent notion of life after death that science could put to a test, and until somebody refines the notion or comes up, as Hume said, with some new principles of reason that enable us to get further on this issue, that's where we're stuck.
You know what it reminded me of when I heard you say that is a while back I had the opportunity, the very fortunate opportunity, to hear Houston Smith speak, who's of course a scholar of the world's religions, and he said something I thought was really interesting. He said, you know, if you think of our experience on a physical plane, and we think of the universe, and we look out as far as we can see, and I'm looking out here at the ocean, and I can see maybe 20 or 30 miles, but we know that the universe is 1,000 million light years, and we can't even imagine that dimension. And he said, yet when we think of our spiritual dimension, maybe we think of it in that same kind of misperceived way, you know, in that if we look at the difference between what we can see and how big we know the universe is, and if we look at it from that spiritual dimension, maybe we can start to grasp how much we're really lacking in the ability to really grab those things. And I thought, when I heard you say that, I said, you know, there is something there in terms of until we can get out of really realizing our limitations, we can't even begin to imagine what that other form of logic or analysis or thinking
might
about
be.
Our consciousness might be.
Absolutely. And you know, when that occurred to me, I happen to remember the moment that I realized that. I was a very young kid sitting on my grandmother Waddleton's lap in Porterdale, Georgia, looking up at the stars. It was in the summer, I guess, because I remember it was warm outside. And we were just looking up at the stars across the street, and she was explaining to me how far away they were.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized at that point, my goodness, I will never know much of anything. to me, that's a wonderful state of mind. I mean, I just love to inquire into things and find out new things. And also, always throughout my life, within the limitations that I had sort of intuited from the very beginning, that I'll never, I mean, you know, compared to what there is to know, I will never know very much.
You know, and you're saying that, and you're obviously a very humble person who's made a tremendous contribution.
Oh, no,
here.
No.
Oh,
it's
no, wait.
It's realism.
Well,
it's not humility.
Okay, all right. I'll let that go. But, you know, the thing I wanted to kind of get into is that I think it is easy to misinterpret what you're saying. Maybe let me make sure I'm not misinterpreting it the other way. And that's that, can we use the tools that we do have, as crude as they may be, to explore these issues, to ask the questions about consciousness, about whether consciousness is reducible to brain function or whether it's more. I think a lot of people point to the research that you've pioneered in near-death experience, along with other research that does not fit into the conventional paradigm that we have, and say, look, these things are all pointing towards a new paradigm that we must move to even begin to start formulating what the theories are.
Well, I can't imagine that anybody could do that from this side of the shift, if you know what I mean. I mean, in the sense that these things have always been around. Plato talked about near-death experiences. Democritus wrote a book about near-death experiences. I mean, although we unfortunately have lost that, as scholars know from fragments a little bit of about what was in it. And but, you know, it seems to me to go through these episodic cycles where people become very interested in this, and so I don't know what governs all those cycles, but I just have no idea whether we're shaping up towards some big breakthrough or not. I do feel that some work that I have done, which I would love, incidentally, this is, I'm taking this manuscript up to my literary agent in New York on Monday, but I would just love to send you a copy of it to see what you think. But I have worked out a method of reasoning that I think maybe gets us a hair's breadth closer to rational discourse about life after death. But that's not mainly what the book is about, though. But
What is the title of that new book, Dr. Moody?
The Power of Nonsense. I have been interested in nonsense in the sense of Dr. Seuss and Lewis Carroll and Edward Lear since I was a kid. And if you have studied philosophy, you know that analytical philosophy, which was the major movement of the 20th century and thus far into the 21st century, that one of the primary concepts of analytical philosophy was nonsense. And Plato also was very interested in nonsense and wrote one of his most interesting dialogues about the problem of discerning rational principles that underlie the operation of nonsense or meaningless, unintelligible language. So that has really been sort of my core interest. One thing I think that drew me to cosmology is the fact that it's really at the borderline of intelligibility. I mean, it's you get into that thing when you're a kid, you know, it's like, well, does the universe have an end? Well, you try to go and you imagine a wall, and then you say, well, there's got to be something on the other side of the wall. But then if you think of it the other way around and you say, well, it just goes on and on and on to infinity, well, that seems to be nonsense too. So the trouble is, either way you look at it, you get it's unintelligible from that point of view. So to me, the experience of something being unintelligible and working hard with your reason to try to make sense of it, that's a very gratifying kind of experience for me.
In a nutshell, if you can, how do we get to that other side? How do we get to the other side of reason and logic and still take with us the tools that have worked so well in terms of reason?
Well, you know something? What a wonderful opportunity. I would like to issue a sort of challenge, and I think I've done that. And I'd love to send this manuscript to you and see what you think.
Oh, of course, love to.
Yeah, great, because I do. It's something I've worked on for many decades and can obviously can't say in a paragraph or two, but I'd love to mail this to you and for you to read through it and see what you think. Because of course, you know, I don't know if you've studied philosophy, but paradoxically, what a philosopher, which I don't count myself, I think of myself as a student of philosophy, that what you do paradoxically is you try to get your views down as well as you can and reason them out very carefully, and then you put your work out there. And paradoxically, you're kind of looking for someone to find flaws and weaknesses in your argument, because that's how you move forward, and by correcting it like that. So that's the process I'm in, and I'm really kind of issuing a challenge now that I do think that I've moved things just a hair's breadth closer to the rational understanding of life after death. But again, that's not the major point of the book anyway. But
well, I'd love to explore that, and would love to have you back on and maybe talk to some other philosophers about it too. And we've had a couple of interesting discussions with a Dr. Robert Almeter there at Georgia State.
Oh, yeah, I know Bob.
Very interesting fellow who had we had an interesting dialogue with him as well. So I am not, I'd be way out of my depth there, but that's what you got to do. You got to wade into the water until you sink.
That's right. That's how you do is you, paradoxically, in any study, you learn by going beyond what you know. So what did you...
I am really a computer guy. So I was
computer
science and artificial intelligence, which is kind of a whole other area. Where that kind of came up short is kind of an interesting journey in terms of the whole consciousness thing. And there's still some people who pursue that, but I think most people kind of understand that to be a limited view of consciousness. I want to come back to something, though. Earlier this week, I had a very interesting chat with Dr. Ed Kelly and Dr. Emily Kelly there at the University of Virginia.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but...
Well, I've met her. I don't know him.
They've just come out with a very interesting book titled Irreducible Mind. And what they've tried to do is take kind of a broader perspective at all this anomalous behavior that keeps falling outside of the realm of the existing paradigm that we have about consciousness, and saying, you know, all these things start pointing towards the need for a new paradigm, just in the classic scientific paradigm sense that, you know, we're trying to hold on to it, we're trying to make stuff fit, and then we have a couple little things here that just don't fit, and then eventually we say, you know, we just can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
So, what I really want to kind of push you on a little bit here is, what do you think about how people are moving forward the research in near-death experience? What do you think about the latest research? What is that telling us? What is that telling us about the cross-cultural aspects of it that some people have talked about? What does it tell us about the transformative aspects? If we look at it from a psychological standpoint of being a transformative experience, where do you think that research is most promising? Even if we can't get to a conclusive end, what do you think is the most promising, and what do you think in general about the research in near-death experience?
Well, I am happy to see so many people interested in it, number one. And I think that practically anything anybody could do that would expand our understanding of it a little bit is to the good. I begin to worry when I see the same people who are doing near research into near-death experiences then getting doing research with mediums and so on like that. I have watched mediums perform, but to me this is like entertainment, you know. Not that that justifies it, but I have mixed feelings. I mean, I tend to focus more on what I've been working on. I do feel that I've made a little conceptual advance here, and I'm happy to see people around different parts of the world looking into this cross-culturally and so on. And, I mean, there's a lot. This is something that has, you know, philosophers 2,300 years ago at least, or even before that, realized.
What I hear you saying is you have some reservations because you don't think, let me make sure I'm not misinterpreting it, but you're concerned that we do not have again, the conceptual frame or the logical, the tools, tools, the philosophical tools to really apply
to make
a language
to a scientific issue. That's right. This is not yet scientific. We are still in the pre-scientific phase of looking at this, and to sort of leap right into this to try to prove whatever they're trying to prove, life after death or whatever. I mean, who knows? I mean, one of the easiest things for me to say is that I acknowledge that I may be just completely wrong. But as to where, if I'm following my best guess about what will happen, my guess would be that the more productive things would in the long run turn out to be conceptual studies, just trying to get clearer on this notion of life after death. I don't see anything myself now there that could be put to any sort of scientific test. For one thing, it's not falsifiable. In other words, you can't think of any observation that you could make that, if you made it, would show that there is not a life after death. So there's that kind of, falsifiability, I don't think, is an absolute test in science, but it's something to think about.
Right.
I just think there's a lot of my impression of people who think that, you know, that they can find scientific life scientific evidence of life after death. This just seems to me to be incredibly naive, to tell you.
Well, you know, the one problem with that is you certainly have detractors on the other side who are very, very skeptical of they're the non-believer types. So they're very skeptical of any research in this area because they think it's really, really what they think is it's a religious agenda. It's an agenda to kind of put forth some religious ideas.
Yeah, well, there's another side of it that I have always thought more about is that, number one, that this experience had a lot to do with the formation of the Western intellectual tradition. If you look back to the earliest Greek philosophers, the common view of them was that they were dealing with these kinds of experiences and the questions about the other side. So the very structure of the logic that we have and so on, if you go back to the history of that, you see that it gets interwoven with these experiences. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is that that whatever one thinks about these experiences, they happen to patients who are under medical care. And so, therefore, it's really very important, I think, for physicians to have some awareness of this, because whatever an individual may think of the etiology of this, I think it's pretty clear that people who have a cardiac arrest, for example, and who have something like this happen to them, they really want to be able to talk about it with someone and to say, well, you know, just the mere act of verbalizing it seems to help people and to integrate it. And in that sense, I think it's something that does affect the clinical side of things, too.
Certainly.
But there may be right. I mean, you may be right that some people look at this as a religious agenda. I mean, well, as a matter of fact, a lot of things come to my mind. I've seen that happen. I mean, some people have sort of taken this on as their religion almost.
Right.
So that there's that aspect of it, too. But I think that there are the other two sides of it, too.
Well, you know, one of the things that we try and do on this show, Skeptico, is explore the positions taken by the skeptical community many times. So when I was talking about the Penn and Teller show that you're on, I mean, it was a very, very skeptically oriented kind of view.
Well,
and they have their own agenda.
I want to say this, too, about that word. I really, and this is not like a pedantry, but the fact is that I teach Greek philosophy often, and not doing it right now, but I have it many times in the past, and I anticipate doing it hopefully many times in the future. And always when I get to the skeptics, it irritates me because then I have to say, well, look.
Right. You have to explain what skeptic means, right?
Skeptics are not these guys who are saying this and that, you know, like, oh, these near-death experiences are the chemistry of the brain. I'm skeptical. I think they're the chemistry of the brain. What the skeptical movement was all about, they came in the wake of Aristotle. And Aristotle, of course, taught us a code by which we could reach conclusions. And so after that, what the skeptics decided is, well, what if we don't draw the conclusion? And that was the purpose of these skeptical manuals, some of which you can still get. The one by Sextus Empiricus, for example, survived from antiquity. And he says right there at the beginning of it is that the skeptic is the person who's that the skeptical method is to ask every question, to really apply reason as stringently as you can, but then, as the essence of being a skeptic, they withhold a conclusion. That is the definition of it. Mm-hmm. And the reason they did this was two things. Number one, they found, as I think even Hume sort of said, it does really interesting things to your mind. It's kind of fun. And secondly, that since everybody else is rushing in the same direction to get to the conclusion, but you are avoiding a conclusion, withholding a conclusion, what that does, in effect, is to open up your peripheral vision, and you see side pathways of inquiry that everybody else missed because they were rushing to get to the conclusion. But unfortunately, this so-called skeptical movement, what that has created is this idea. These people say things like, well, I'm a skeptic about near-death experiences. I think they're just the chemistry of the brain.
Right.
Well, if you unpack what that person is saying is, it's, I'm a person who doesn't draw conclusions, and my conclusion is that such and such. So what this movement that falsely labels itself skeptical is not skeptical by the original skeptics. And that's where I mean, that's the real point of view that I think being a skeptic is just practicing a method of stringent adherence to the rules of inquiry, but then in the end withholding a conclusion just because, suspending judgment, as it were, and just saying, well, I don't know.
You know, that's a wonderful explanation. I've had to explain on many times the title of the show, Skeptico, is from the Greek skeptikos, which I'm of Greek ancestry, and I thought it was great. And
Wonderful.
And folks just jump on me. Oh, you're not skeptic, but you're not a skeptic. I'm like, you don't understand. Uh-huh. Skepticos means to withhold this, to opine,
that's
but
right.
Not to come to a conclusion. So
that's right, exactly.
Very good.
Yeah, if you
have a little
too bad.
Yes, it is. If you have a little bit more time, Dr. Moody, great. Could I play for you a couple of clips from a couple of folks who were on the show previously and get your...
Yeah.
Okay, so the first one that we're going to hear is from a gentleman named Dr. David Lester, and he's a professor of psychology at Richard Stockton College in New Jersey, and he wrote this book, Is There Life After Death? An Examination of the Empirical Evidence, in which he finds that there isn't any, and he's very, very sure of that. So I wanted to play that, and then here we go.
Okay.
And I don't feel we have to explain Raymond Moody's classic description of the near-death experience because we're not sure that that is what people are experiencing. He said it. That's what it is. Other people have said, oh, I had one like that. But other people have said, oh, I had a different one. So we're not even sure what we have to explain yet.
If I can, I'm going to play that one for you again. It's from Dr. Sue Blackmore. She's a very well-known skeptic based in the UK. And she she studied this more, and you'll hear what she says. She directly contradicts the other skeptic who says it doesn't exist. But she says these are just...
Well, that's a fine thing for skeptics to do.
That is.
And for them to contradict each other.
It is. And her position basically is these are just strange experiences, but they don't really point to anything about human consciousness, and they couldn't possibly provide any evidence for a survival of consciousness. But I don't need to introduce it anymore. Let me play it, and then it's a rather long clip, and then I want to get your response to the two of them juxtaposed together.
Okay.
Let's address near-death experiences properly and scientifically. Right, what do we know? We know they've happened in all the cultures we've studied. They happen again and again. They happen to people close to death and at other times. They have common features, the tunnel, the light at the end, the life review, the decision to return, other beings, the feelings of warmth and joy and acceptance, sometimes the judgment, self-judgment. All of these things we know extensively. So what do we do then? Well, let's look at the evidence. The evidence in near-death experiences that anybody actually sees anything at a distance that they shouldn't see is lousy. I know you'll tell me about tennis shoes. There was only one person and no other witness to that tennis shoe on the ledge in Seattle. I know you might tell me the famous Wilmot case, someone traveling across the Atlantic. That was a story told by only one person. I know you can tell me stories of people who are blind and see again. But even Ken Ring, who is the greatest expert on this, will say, yes, but maybe it wasn't exactly seeing. And we know that people who are blind imagine the world. They have good spatial sense through other senses. So in my mind, and honestly, I researched these things for a long, long time, there is no good, sound evidence that anything leaves the body during near-death experiences.
Okay. Any thoughts on that?
Well, again, I had a little trouble hearing a few of the words, but generally, I would tend to side with her on saying that it certainly does seem to me that there's a pattern in these things. If somebody else can find plenty of near-death experiences that are just way beyond the pale compared to the narrative pattern that is sort of in circulation, I mean, I would just love to hear them, but I just haven't seen that many. I mean, once in a while I do hear something. But of course, I mean, you just can't make a judgment about that. I mean, maybe if people have an experience that is different, they feel embarrassed to talk to me, but I just don't know. I just don't know. But that's the virtue of having a lot of people with different perspectives looking at this, because if there are other patterns out there, hopefully somebody will find them and we can talk about them. Because, you know, what we're dealing here with is narratives. And that's what keeps getting lost in this. I mean, the parapsychologists, I've never known of one of them who knows a shred of interest or has any knowledge about narratology, for example. Well, narratology is the study of narratives. And what you have that is allegedly the residue of a near-death experience is a narrative. So why don't people get interested in narrative structure and so on? But you never hear any of that. I think, that's what we're really dealing with is narrative. And I also don't like the way that people say, oh, these are anecdotal. Well, an anecdote is something you tell in the living room, you know, around the fire or whatever. A narrative, we're talking about a definite pattern here. So that's what I find interesting, that the narratives of people who come back from close calls with death, at least the ones that I have heard, do seem to suggest some overall pattern that's at work somehow there. And the cause of that, I don't understand.
You know, you kind of point to a very interesting area of research that I don't know a lot of people have explored, but certainly in psychology, isn't there a whole branch of psychology that's interested in this kind of narrative aspect to our understanding of our world, right? I mean, it's...
Oh, well, I would be interested in that because it's with my interest in philosophy of language. I was interested in narratology from the very beginning. I think it was in the year 1969, as I recall, that the first real solid book about narratology came out, and I was I've been into it from then. But that's interesting that what they use it for...
Well, a form of therapy is to tell your story and then to kind of look at that through other stories. But it's an interesting, very interesting point, very interesting point. And from our earlier conversation, I should have anticipated the reaction that you would have. You will now become, for all skeptical listeners, for all time, the quintessential skeptic, because you will not be pushed into forming an opinion. I think that's just a wonderful, wonderful model. And I'm going to have to come back and listen to this broadcast whenever I start. Well, you know, when you get pushed, you kind of, and that's, I think, the problem on both sides of this debate. When you get pushed, there's a natural reaction to kind of want to push back and go, no, damn it, we've proved it. And here's the proof. You're just stubborn in a very good way, in that you're not going to get pushed into that cheap answer.
Because it's so much fun to apply the rules of reason. And, I mean, that it's like people don't. People resort to reason because they are seeking the unique legitimacy that reason provides.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, nobody balances their checkbook by the astrology column, right? You use arithmetic because you full well know that if you follow the rules correctly, you'll end up with the same answer as the guy in the bank, right? Or anybody else. And so that's the fun of it, is the thought, you know, just to enact that procedure, and then you know there's a reliability attached to what you come out with. But I just see it happen too many times that these people with this idea, oh yeah, I believe, and they don't realize they're doing it. But you know, I already believe in ESP or mm-hmm. you know, life after death or whatever it is. And then it seems from my experience that almost no matter what experiment they do, so-called experiment, it's gonna end up supporting the starting belief. And that, to mm-hmm. me, that must be a very, very stressful kind of inner way of being.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I mean either way, I mean whether they disbelieve or believe, I mean it's really the same thing. And you know, to finagle the rules to make it come out like you want, I mean, what's the fun of that?
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. You've been very generous with your time, and I appreciate it. For any of you out there listening, and if you are not familiar with the book Life After Life, it's an absolute classic, a must read, and we'll certainly look for it. I would very, very much like to talk to you after I get my hands on The Power of Nonsense, your new book, and explore that with you some more.
Wonderful.
But for now, I just have to thank you again for joining us.
Well, thank you, Alex. I've had a wonderful time.
Wow, what a great opportunity that was to talk to Dr. Raymond Moody today. What a fresh and interesting perspective. You know, it's why it's so fun to do the Skeptico show, to be able to talk to folks like that, whose books you've read, whose ideas you think you know, and then to get in a real conversation with them and find out just how they're really thinking and how sometimes that's different than the way that you would take it. And it kind of sends you off in a different direction. To me, it's just so exciting. Well, thanks for joining us, and thanks for plugging Skeptico. I've gotten some very nice mentions in folks' blogs and in other places where people have written reviews about the show and have said very kind things, and that's helpful. That's just very encouraging. You know, you sit and you do a show, and you're not sure who exactly you're speaking to, if anyone. And again, this is my journey, and I've just invited anyone who wants to come along and explore with me these questions. So it's encouraging and heartening when you get positive feedback and you get people who want to tell other folks about the show. That's always fun and exciting. So that's going to about do it for this week. We have a very interesting couple of shows coming up. The shows will be moving, as this one did, to every other week. I'm finding it hard to balance my time between Skeptico and open source science and to do a good job of getting a show out every week. and at the same time be able to make a contribution to open source science, which is a project that I'm very committed to. So every other week for at least a while, and then we'll see after that. Okay, thanks again, and bye for now.